Cincinnati edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Today we come to you from our downstairs neighbors, CET, because we are joined by a live audience that's mostly made up of our friends and also our younger friends, students from the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. We are discussing the state of the nation, no easy task, with someone else who also happens to be here live and in person with us, the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome.
Oh my God, thank you, Michael.
Very enthusiastic, excited to have you here. Usually it's by phone. We're so glad to have you live and in person today. As always, we're also joined by WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
Thank you, thank you.
And we're pleased to have our frequent guest, Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thank you for coming back down. Our students in attendance today are from the School for Creative and Performing Arts. They are part of Mr. Harvey Lewis's American Government class, and they are juniors and seniors. So glad y'all could join us today as we talk about important events. We are currently streaming also on the Facebook page that belongs to 91.7 WVXU. If you'd like to see what Ken Rudin looks like, now's your chance.
Wow.
Do so at your own risk, I suppose. Oh, we are all much more handsome on radio, but we do have a lovely camera, which I think flatters us, so we should be pleased with that as well. So glad you're listening. We always, students, during this program, offer up a trivia question to our listening audience, and Ken Rudin rewards our winning caller with a spectacular gift. But because of this special day with Ken Rudin in the flesh and you all here with us as well, the trivia question belongs only to the students who are in attendance today. So one of you with a correct answer will get a prize. Ken, tell them what they could win today.
They could win, Johnny, an ottoman, a bedroom set, and a very rare political junkie button for your collection.
That's awesome. Please allow 90 days for the bedroom suit to show up, and sorry, no CODs. You don't know what that means. I just realized that. That's all right. So, let's ask the question.
Well, with the New Hampshire primary coming up on Tuesday, I have an Ohio-related question. What Ohio candidate got the most votes in the history of the New Hampshire primary?
Okay. So think about that for a while. We'll check in on what your answers might be. Don't shout it out, and do not Google. No Googling, none of that. If you want to collaborate with your partners, that's up to you. I consider that cheating. So if you just want to think on your own, work on your own paper, eyes on your own paper, that would be appreciated. We'll check in with you. Again, the question is, which presidential candidate from Ohio got the most raw votes in a New Hampshire primary? Okay, we'll check
in. And they did not have to use the Iowa app.
Thank goodness for that.
That's
we'll
right.
see how that's going. We are going to talk a little bit about Iowa. Let's dive right in, though, and talk about this morning, because President Trump showed up at the National Prayer Breakfast, an annual event in Washington, D.C. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was there, too, the first time they shared a stage in a couple of days. And a couple of days ago, Ken, it was quite a dramatic scene. We had some criticism of the president's State of the Union as sort of a hyper-partisan re-election pep rally State of the Union speech. We also saw criticism of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who ripped the State of the Union physically in half while the broadcast was still on. A very dramatic scene. And today, President Trump showed up at the prayer breakfast with USA Today, print edition. You kids don't know what that is either, I imagine, but it's a newspaper that you would hold and flip through and read about things that were happening. And there's a headline that says, "Acquitted," above the fold, huge letters. And Trump was celebrating his acquittal from the Senate. So I guess let's just start with where things are in the national political landscape based on the way the two leaders, the Republican leader and the Democratic leader, what is the state of national politics as of today?
Well, President Trump was acquitted by the Senate as we knew he would be from the beginning. While he was impeached by the House, obviously you need two-thirds. Constitution says you need two-thirds of a vote to convict in the Senate, which meant 67 senators to convict, which also meant 20 Republicans voting to convict and remove from office President Trump. That never was going to happen. Basically, all the excitement about the impeachment trial ended once four Republicans didn't come forward to ask for witnesses. That would have extended the trial, but ultimately it would not have changed the final thing, the final verdict, which was that he was acquitted. So we have a president like Bill Clinton, who was impeached by the House, acquitted by the Senate. I know that in history, history will record Donald Trump as one of only three presidents in American history to be impeached, which is a blot on the record. But of course, the way the president is looking at it and the way his supporters are looking at it is that he was also acquitted. And therefore, it was a big victory for the president. Now, of course, we are recording this show as the president is speaking to the nation, where I suspect he will also see it as a victory lap, the fact that his party stood with him, except for one Republican, Mitt Romney.
And that's exactly what I wanted to ask, was whether the president is looking at this as some sort of victory. He looked victorious today, was acting victorious today, wielding the paper, holding it up with the headline acquittal. But I also want to reference Nancy Pelosi's actions at the State of the Union address, because this is someone who had held up the standards of congressional decorum even when it was so divided leading up to the impeachment. At one point, basically shushing her own caucus to not make any celebratory noise when she was announcing these articles, who now drifted into this apparent violation of decorum by at least making this statement. So that's what I want to know is, where does this take us now? Because even the leader of the Democratic Party at the national level, the highest ranking Democrat in the country, has now apparently looked at the situation and thought, when they go low, we'll go low too now.
That is true. That is interesting. And if you look at the three impeachments in our lifetime, or some of our lifetimes, Nixon, not yours, but Nixon, Clinton, and Trump, you think of the Speaker of the House, Carl Albert with Richard Nixon, Denny Hastert with Bill Clinton. They were not, they let the Judiciary Committee and the impeachment process go on without really involvement. Nancy Pelosi tried to work a fine line when it came to impeachment. She wasn't going to bring it forward until she thought that the majority of her caucus was ready for it, because there was a lot of antipathy from moderate Democrats who were elected in 2018 and said, look, I'm elected from Trump districts, districts that elected Donald Trump in 2016. I don't want to push for impeachment, which could go against the majority of the voters in my district. So Nancy Pelosi held off for the longest time, fought for decorum, fought for order, and yet the animosity between Trump and Speaker Pelosi just grew and grew, even as before the State of the Union began, when Nancy Pelosi extended her hand to shake the president's hand, he snubbed her on that. So it was just, it sounds petty, it sounds childish, it sounds ugly, it's true on all three counts. And Nancy Pelosi responded in kind by ripping the president's speech in half in a dramatic announcement, saying that there's less truth to this speech than meets the eye. And of course, to their credit, I say credit in quotes, Matt Gaetz, one of the Republicans, Trump's strongest supporters in the House, announced that he wants Nancy Pelosi brought up on charges for defacing, destroying U.S. government property by ripping up the speech. Yikes. So it doesn't get any better, and even though, yes, he is acquitted, he may be on a victory lap this week. I suspect he is still angry and upset about what happened, and still resentful of both Nancy Pelosi and Mitt Romney.
I do want to correct one thing. I don't think the Nixon proceedings happened in the lifetime of me or Dr. Bloom either. Just correct. We're not as young as the SCPA people, but we're not as old as you and I.
What about Andrew Johnson?
I was there for that. Okay. I was there for that. A little time travel does the body good. Howard, I do want to talk about what Ken just said, though, about Matt Gaetz, the Florida Republican congressman who did announce that he was filing this complaint against House Speaker Pelosi for her actions because, again, what it seems that we're seeing is that Republicans will hold Democrats to a standard that they won't even begin to hold the president to.
That's right, and it's hypocrisy. And it's, number one, it's absurd. I mean, the whole idea of destroying public property, I mean, come on. You know, he handed her a piece, you know, a copy of his speech. She can do with it whatever she likes. It didn't look good. and it just fed into this, you know, confrontational atmosphere in Washington. But on one sense, you can hardly blame her after this, the frustration that she has gone through over the last several months, and having to sit there and listen to him put on a State of the Union address, which was, frankly, a variety show, more of a television entertainment show than a serious speech, and was full of all kinds of inaccuracies and just outright lies, and she went nuts. Okay, fine, that's over with. But he is on this victory tour, where he is going to be the sorest loser in the history of mankind, and just keep talking and talking and talking about this at the National Prayer Breakfast. You know, he is calling the Democrats all kinds of names. He's, you know, talking about, oh, I'm going to pray for you, but you know, you're terrible, awful human beings.
And let me ask you, Dr. Bloom, an assistant professor from Miami University, a frequent guest here on our program, let's talk about prolonging the narrative about the relationship between the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership. So we saw the president's speech, we saw the House Speaker, really more than just tearing up the State of the Union copy, sort of mocking the president behind his back while we were watching. I recall when the president offered this very awkward line about socialism divides a nation or destroys a nation, but freedom unifies the soul. And Nancy Pelosi literally looked around confused and then mouthed that line back to herself, freedom unifies the soul? You know, you could see this. What happens now if the Republicans try to exploit Nancy Pelosi's behavior, even though they had very little to say about President Trump's allegedly perfect phone call to the Ukraine? Will this play out? Will this work for them?
I'm sure that they'll try to get a little bit more media attention out of it, but there's very little they can do when they don't control the House. But I think this episode gets at something much bigger, like a bigger question about our democracy and what America is about. You hear a lot of the punditocracy talking about this need for a post-ideological era where everyone just gets along and cooperates and reaches across the aisle and compromises. But the framers designed our system to have a conflict, a constant conflict, between the branches. So one way to look at this is that Congress and the executive branch are in conflict, in gridlock, which is what the system was designed to do, because it was supposed to stop any one branch from being able to grab too much power.
But you know what it reminds me of? We're talking about Nancy Pelosi's faces and the actions, which is seemingly unprecedented, but if many people here may remember that when Barack Obama, President Obama, gave a national address with a joint session of Congress, he was interrupted by Joe Wilson, the Republican from South Carolina, who yelled out, "You lie." So, I mean, we've seen disruptions from the House before, never, though, from the Speaker of the House, which was pretty much pretty dramatic.
One thing I always find interesting from an international political perspective is when you think about the American culture and the British culture, I think just typically we think of British people being more refined and classier, and we're a little, you know,
until Boris Johnson.
Well, that's not what I mean. Okay. But I mean, like, when we get to watch the House of Commons on television, it's very raucous and exciting, and people are mocking one another openly, but like in clever, smart ways. We are very, very pristine in the way that our traditional national events take place, and even in the way members of Congress address one another from the floor and the way that they're recognized. It's very formal.
Distinguished gentleman from Florida, right?
Correct, exactly. So we're very formal with those things. I wonder if maybe we just let our guard down and allowed people to just, okay, let's hash this out the way they do across the pond. Do you think that maybe we should change the way we even try to engage in legislative dialogue?
Well, if we do, we've learned from the top. And that means since January of 2017, we've had somebody who has talked about the media being the enemy of the American people, that you know, you're a fool, the things that Donald Trump has said about members of Congress of both parties, the criticism, the loss of, the lack of decorum when he would address people. Basically sounds like the fights you'll see in the House of Commons, and I think it is permeating through the role of Congress as well, the members of Congress.
Well, can you mention that the president has gone after members of both parties? We talked at an event last night at NKU about this a little bit, and noting the fact that now supporters of President Trump are very angry with Senator Mitt Romney, a Republican who voted to convict the president on one of the two articles of impeachment, becoming the first member of a political party to vote to convict a president who is a member of his party in an impeachment trial. And now supporters are really going after Mitt Romney, who maybe we forget that just 8 years ago, Mitt Romney was the presidential nominee for the Republican Party. We remember the way President Trump talked about Republican Senator, the late John McCain of Arizona. He was the presidential nominee in 2008. The current supporters of Trump are either lukewarm or cold to former President George W. Bush. I'm wondering if we're living in like a post-ideological world where now the fascination and the support doesn't come from any type of thought, any type of policy, it's just personality. And I'll let the whole panel answer that.
Let me just say one quick thing. This is Donald Trump's party. This is not the party of Romney, McCain, Bush, or even Reagan. This is Donald Trump's party. And basically what went along, what happened in the past is old history. This is a new era under Donald Trump.
Yeah, and this is, Ken says, this is his party now. And there is no room for dissent. There is no room for a Mitt Romney, you know, to stand up and say, no, I cannot vote to acquit him on these charges, or on at least one of the charges. And that's sad. I mean, that is really sad because this is a cult of personality. It's become a cult of personality, the Republican Party, which is not what it was intended to be. And it is not what it has been during its history. And the fact that they can't let this go and let somebody like Mitt Romney express himself without being pilloried all over the country is shameful. And it has, you know, it has some real horrible implications for the future.
Maybe if you tell them pillory rhymes with Hillary, they'll stay a little bit farther away from that type of behavior.
But this thing is going to have to stop in terms of this victory lap and his, you know, him being a sore winner, because people are just going to get tired of it. You know, it's not going to gain him anything with his base. They can only hear it so many times, and then he's going to have to move on to something else and start talking about serious issues, you know, whenever the Democrats can get their act together and find a person to run against him. He's going to have to get serious.
And your thoughts, Dr. Bloom?
I have a slightly different take. So you're all aware we're in a two-party system. If you're not completely aware of the reasons why, it has to do with our electoral rules. We have single-member districts. But in most other countries, there are multiple little parties, and they form coalitions in the legislative branch, so in parliament. In the U.S., those little groups, little parties, little factions, all form a coalition before the election, and we call these things parties, but they're really mass parties or big tents. So one way to think about the Trump presidency is that it's the victory of a certain faction of the Republican Party that really wanted to prioritize different ideological ideas. So you think about the Tea Party and their deep desire to take the country back. The status threat that really animated the Tea Party is ideological in a certain way, and it was an attempt to put different people in power. So this might be less of a cult of personality and a war between different factions in the Republican Party. And I think if we focus a little bit more on the inside of the parties, the fights that happen within them, that there's a more interesting story to tell.
We are seeing that play out in both parties, it appears, and we will talk a little bit about that on the Democratic side as well. We're going to get a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by students from the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. We'll answer some of your questions as well, but only if you can answer our question, Ken. Remind them of the trivia question.
It is, what candidate from Ohio received the most votes in the history of the New Hampshire primary.
We've got a political junkie button on the line. I know it's very popular with the teenagers these days, so we want to make sure that you get that. Yes, absolutely. You are listening to The Political Junkie on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Today we come to you from our downstairs neighbors, CET, because we are joined by a live audience of our friends and students from the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. They are juniors and seniors of Mr. Harvey Lewis's American Government class. And we are also joined live and in person for our annual in-person visit by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, we're so glad to have you here in town.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks, Michael.
I know you're thrilled. We just had a great lunch. Very cool.
For free. You know, there's no such thing.
Our donors probably paid for it, and it was well-spent money. Dr. Rachel Bloom is an assistant professor of political science at Miami University, also here with us. Dr. Bloom, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Howard Wilkinson, WVXU senior political analyst and longtime local journalist. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Okay, just before we went to break, we asked the trivia question. We want these students in the audience to think about it. I'll ask you, Ken, one more time to remind our listening audience what that question is.
What Ohio presidential candidate received the most votes in the New Hampshire primary?
Okay, so here's what we'll do. We'll do it like it's class. If you think you've got a right answer, I will ask you to raise your hand. I'll call on you. You come up to the mic and you can make your guess. Who has an answer? Oh, we're going to need more time to think. It looks. I saw a half hand. Is there anybody who wants to make a guess? There's only a little bit of shame in getting it wrong.
So is it John Kasich?
John Kasich is his answer.
The answer is... Wait.
Checking the notes.
John Kasich is correct.
Oh!
He got 44,000 votes against Donald Trump in 2016.
What is your name?
My name is Ken Rudin. I'm sorry.
I'm Henry.
Hi, Henry. Well done. Congratulations. Okay. And I look forward to seeing you in your new political junkie pen. That's going to be great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Now, I understand that, Henry, you can stay at the mic because I believe you're one of the students selected to ask questions to us, selected by the school. And we've got this distinguished panel here and me to help you out with it. So why don't you go ahead and ask us your question?
All right, so my question is, I come from a liberal family that now has pretty moderate views since the Democrat Party has moved pretty far left in the last couple of years. My fear is that the party has moved too far left, and if the Democrats nominate a far left candidate instead of a centrist candidate, the President Trump will label the Democrats as crazy socialists and win again in November.
That's a great question, Henry. We appreciate it very much, and we'll allow our panel an opportunity to do that. And let's start over at the end with Howard this time, because this is obviously an internal struggle for the Democratic Party, so much so that it's a very open argument.
Henry, that's a really real fear, and it's something that the Democrats are going to have to face. The Democrats seem to be in this argument about ideology versus, you know, winning. And in my opinion, the object of an election is to win. And then if you have divisions within your party, and every party does, you can work it out after the election. The main objective of the Democrats in 2020 should be always get this guy out of office. Let's, you know, no matter who we end up nominating, you know, that is the job of the Democratic Party, and I think they're about to fail at it if they keep on this path. We had the situation 4 years ago where Hillary Clinton was running, and she had faced Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and Bernie Sanders, you know, gave her a run for her money. But he lost. He lost the nomination. And in November of 2016, fully one quarter of the Bernie Sanders voters did not vote for Hillary Clinton. They just sat it out. They said, no way, we're not going to do it. That one fact could have cost her, probably did cost her the whole election.
Dr. Bloom, would you like to weigh in?
Yes. So I love your question. And to me, there are two different parts of it. And the first part is this whole left-center kind of question. And I think you're absolutely right that there's a tension. The Democratic Party, or whatever the left party in the U.S. is at a time, has never really been on the left. So it's always been what would be called a liberal party in Europe, but for them that's conservative. But Bernie Sanders has a different vision, and I think part of the problem is when you have just two parties, you have more viewpoints than can be encapsulated in just two parties, and that's exactly what's happening right now. So that gets to the second part, which is the nomination question. So the candidate who a party nominates in this final contest is hopefully the best candidate who can win, or at least that's like the conventional wisdom on it. All the factions, they have to come together and form some sort of compromise, at least for the next 4 years to keep going. I don't think that Bernie Sanders is someone that the entire coalition can form a compromise around, but it's possible. I've been wrong before. But if we think about what a coalition needs in order to form a stable majority that can move forward, I think your family's concerns are absolutely spot on.
Ken, it's not unusual for a party's primary to have debate over electability, viability, who can grow the party, who can compete in November against the other party. That's not unusual. I'm wondering if your sense is, and using the Democrats since they're the ones having a primary now, is whether those types of debates are getting more extreme. Because what we're seeing on social media anyway, I'm a big Twitter user, between supporters of Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, versus the former South Bend, Indiana mayor, Pete Buttigieg's supporters, it's really intense right now. Bernie supporters have a strong loathing already for this previously unknown person.
The debate within the party, and that's why it is a very good question, between electability and purity has been going on a long time. But here's a good example. In 1972, the Democrats wound up endorsing George McGovern, who for the most part was out of the party's mainstream, very left of center, especially when it came to Vietnam, and the nominal centrists like Hubert Humphrey and Ed Muskie, they were defeated. I know these names may not mean that much to you, but it was a battle between the liberals and the centrists in 72. George McGovern won the nomination, and he got killed by Richard Nixon in November, lost 49 out of 50 states. So the Democrats said, we'll never let this happen again. Well, in 1984, we'll pick Walter Mondale, who is the establishment, who's part of the mainstream, and he was nominated, and he lost 49 out of 50 states to Ronald Reagan. So we don't know what electability means anymore. If theoretically Joe Biden is the most electable candidate, well, he finished fourth in Iowa. He could also finish fourth in New Hampshire. Does that mean Joe Biden is the most electable candidate, even though some polls show him beating President Trump the most? So we don't know that. Republicans in 2016 said, we don't want those moderate, squishy moderates like John McCain and Mitt Romney. We want Donald Trump. Most of the mediocracy or the pundits said, he's so far to the right, he'll never win with his personal life or the crazy things he said, and he won. He didn't win the popular vote, but he is the 45th president of the United States. So while those debates do go on, we are in no position to say who is extreme and who's not. Can Bernie Sanders win? Personally, I don't think so. I don't think Donald Trump could win either, and he did. Well, let's see what the voters have to say. We have a long way to go.
And it is interesting to note that as this debate rages within the Democratic Party, you have a candidate representing the farther left wing. You have another candidate representing the more moderate, centrist, traditional Democratic wing. And they're basically in a virtual tie.
And after two wings, I hang up.
Oh, I just love your comedy show, Ken Rudin. I do indeed. Let's go back out to the School for Creative and Performing Arts. We have another student with a question. What's your name?
My name's Anthony.
Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the show, and we'd love to hear your question.
Okay. Do you believe the technological problems with the Iowa caucus will hurt the Democratic Party in the eyes of the Republicans and undecided?
Great question, Anthony. Thank you so much. We'll allow the pundits up here to answer those questions. Ken, why don't we start with you on, I guess, the political ramifications that are coming from the coverage of this collapse of an app that was supposed to be used to tabulate the results of the Iowa caucuses.
Donald Trump is having a field day with it. He's mocking the Democrats, and justifiably. The fact is the candidates spent a year in Iowa. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, everything was there, and they just blew it. I don't blame the candidates. I do blame the app. I do blame the Iowa Democratic Party. And consequently, I think that's the end of the Iowa leading off the calendar, because they've kind of had problems three cycles in a row, 2012, 2016, and now. Do I think ultimately it will matter? It reminds me a little bit of Barack Obama's that failed rollout of Obamacare when the app didn't work or the website didn't work, and everybody says, and the Republicans said, oh, this is such a disaster. Eventually people forgot about it. And again, if the rest of the Democratic process in Iowa, in the country, starting with New Hampshire next Tuesday, goes fine, I think the only people who will suffer for it is the Iowa Democratic Party, not the candidates.
Dr. Bloom, I wonder if you might help us understand how this is really impacting Democratic voters. This sort of builds upon our previous conversation about the ideological mix within the party. You've got some people naturally inclined not to trust the establishment party. This app is somehow being connected to the establishment wing of the party, and now there are all sorts of conspiracies floating out there on mainstream social media anyway. What are the potential ramifications of that?
Well, this may surprise a lot of people, but in my experience, the Iowa caucuses don't matter to a lot of voters. A lot of my students, at least, I mean, they're following the Iowa caucuses because I'm making them, but otherwise, they would just kind of hear what they hear, and Super Tuesday happens, and you don't vote yet, or your state isn't up yet, and it's what people in another state are doing, and it's only so interesting. The one thing I could see happening from this, and the thing I've been hearing from my students, is that it raises questions about election security more generally. And I think people who are in my generation or your generation, like one of my earlier really distinct political memories is Florida and the hanging chads, which I'm still not clear on what that was, but Al Gore and George Bush had some kind of weird contest, and we didn't know who the president was. And there have been more and more incidences like that, or at least in my perception. So I could see voters, especially younger voters, wondering, like, why participate? Will my vote be counted? Will it matter? Is it rigged? Is someone interfering? I would like to hope it's not. Election security is the bulwark of democracy, but I could see that being a real concern.
And Howard, the point that Dr. Bloom makes there is an interesting one, because when you reference the hanging chads, Rachel, I'm thinking about the students who are in the audience with us, knowing that they weren't born when that happened.
I realized that after I said it.
Yeah, well, but also it's only 20 years ago, and so there have been, counting the year 2000, there have been five presidential elections. In two of them, the winner did not win the popular vote. And it seems like if you're coming of age in this era, it doesn't seem unreasonable to have a natural hesitation to trust the American electoral system as it stands now.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and it's very troubling. Now, most of the young people I talk to, like at Walnut Hills, where Ken and I were this morning, those kids were, I think they still have some faith in the process in the system, but they're anxious to get involved in it personally. And as far as I was concerned and the app is concerned, I don't think it's the app at all. I mean, it's Iowa. It's just a mess. And it has been as Ken points out, for the last three election cycles, one Republican, two Democratic primaries, has just been an awful mess. It took like 3 weeks before we knew that Rick Santorum defeated Mitt Romney. Yep, right. And what did that mean in the long run? Nothing.
Well, I'll tell you what it did mean. It did rob Santorum of momentum coming out of Iowa.
Yes. And well, that's
I think
true.
The app problem this week robbed momentum of any candidate.
Of any candidate.
Who tried to come out.
Right? And it didn't help the timing with impeachment and State of the Union. You had all these things sort of piling on the news cycle of what you would have been trying to ride in New
Hampshire. But I still think the time has come for this First in the Nation caucus to be done. Get it's outserved its usefulness. There's absolutely no reason why a state with just under 1% of the total population should be having that much influence on the presidential campaign. So if it goes away, I'll be happy. And I'll tell you the truth, I've been seeing more and more state Democratic Party people, you know, saying, hey, this has got to stop. In Ohio, both the Ohio Democratic Party chairman and the deputy chairman in the Republican Party have come out and said, Iowa is useless. We need to stop this. We need a new system.
Howard, you're a baseball guy. I mean, do you think that Iowa really peaked with the Kevin Costner movie Field of Dreams?
Yeah. Well, that's the only thing worth seeing in Iowa anyway.
I'm sorry, students. Kevin Costner was an actor who was very popular in the 80s and the 90s. We have another student who wants to ask a question. Oh, please, say your name and let us have your question.
Hi, I'm Julian McKinney. Historically, is it known to have low placement in the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary and then go on to win a nomination and presidency even?
Great question, Julian. So, Ken, you're probably great for that question. Is like in the annals of history, and you specialize in that.
I do. I could remember what I had for lunch yesterday. It's amazing. what's interesting is that Iowa is more predictive on the Democratic side than is on the Republican side. If you think of the last four competitive Democratic contests in Iowa, 2000, Al Gore won Iowa. John Kerry won it in 2004. Barack Obama won it in 2008. So all those times, and now Hillary Clinton won it in 2016. All of them went on to win the nomination. On the Republican side in 2016, Ted Cruz won Iowa. In 2012, it was Mike Huckabee who won Iowa. In 2008, it was Rick Santorum. 2012 was Rick Santorum, right? So and 2008 was Huckabee. Yeah. So having said that. On the Democratic side, Iowa is far more predictive than it is for the Republican. So ultimately, it's the job of Iowa has never been to predict the nominee. It does winnow the field. It does give some candidates momentum. That doesn't mean they're going to win in New Hampshire, let alone the nomination. But I think it takes out removes some of the weaker candidates. But historically, the winner of the Iowa caucuses usually go on the Democratic side, go on to win the nomination, more so than on the Republican side.
And I'll build a little on Julian's question, Rachel, because I think it's interesting this time that we didn't see any candidates drop out after Iowa. It's typical to have the largest field that you're going to have once voting starts in the first place, Iowa. But to have it so spread out and to have multiple candidates with ceilings, as they say, places to grow their voting base in upcoming states. So you've got Joe Biden probably looking to South Carolina, Bernie's looking to New Hampshire, other candidates might be thinking about other states where they're polling within striking distance and can gain momentum. Is this a unique year in that respect?
It might be unique, but it might not be a departure from a trend in that this might be part of a new trend. Another thing that we aren't talking about but probably should, or at least I think we should, so I will, is Bloomberg, who's not even going to put his name on a ballot until Super Tuesday, which effectively, whatever you think of Bloomberg is beside the point. That means that those primaries become much, much more important because anybody who wants to know anything about how he's going to do has to wait. That probably changes the calculus of the candidates because the way our nominating system has worked since the McGovern-Fraser reforms of 1972 gives a lot more power to like the invisible primary of public opinion.
And the McGovern-Fraser reforms will be on the test, y'all, so I hope that you're listening to the notes on
down
that.
We're going
to be
Fraser. Citing that. Down goes Fraser.
But Ken, is there another example of an election year with a candidate like Bloomberg that's sort of lurking in the peripheral, working really hard, spending boatloads of money, but not participating in the early primaries?
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's not exactly the same, but for example, in 2008, 2007, people are not going to remember this, but Rudy Giuliani was the front runner for the Republican nomination. He was a front runner, and he decided he was going to wait till Florida. He wanted to be the president of Florida. And he waited. He ignored Iowa, he ignored New Hampshire. But while other candidates were winning in those states, nobody cared about what Rudy Giuliani was going to do. And by the time he got to Florida, he got clobbered. In 1972, everybody said, let's just wait for Hubert Humphrey to run. If he runs, he's really going to be, in 76, let's wait for Hubert Humphrey. He's going to be the great nominee. And let's wait for Frank Church, who is a senator from Idaho. Once he runs, that'll really change things. But the American people are influenced. What Dr. Bloom said is true, but they are influenced by Iowa and New Hampshire. So I think if you ignore the early contest, you pay a price. The difference, of course, is that Michael Bloomberg has already spent $251 million on a campaign, more than all the Democrats combined, and he has not even appeared. He's not going to appear in the first four states. So I would like to see if Joe Biden does collapse, and if he's a nominal centrist candidate, I'd like to see what effect Michael Bloomberg has, because I think his commercials are very, very effective. And if the Democratic establishment decides it wants to stop Bernie Sanders, if that's going to happen, they may turn to a Michael Bloomberg. And if that's the case, there will be a real battle for the Democratic nomination.
We're going to take another quick break. I'll let you
hold
that.
Wait, I'm still talking. So anyway,
somebody cut his mic. Cut his mic. We're going to take another quick break. We will come back with a couple more questions from our guests from the School for the Creative and Performing Arts. You are listening to The Political Junkie on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. You hear applause on this show today because we are live in our neighbor's studios downstairs at CET, and we're joined by students from the School for Creative and Performing Arts. They are juniors and seniors from Mr. Harvey Lewis's American Government course, and that is because we have the political junkie in person with us this time, Ken Rudin. So glad that you're with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And we have Dr. Rachel Bloom from Miami University. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And Howard Wilkinson from right here at WVXU also managed to find his way on our panel again. And we're glad
Thank
that you're
you,
here,
Michael.
Howard. All right, so we've only got like 6 minutes left in this program. I know that we got a couple students who want to ask questions. The teacher wants to ask a question. And we can move quickly with our answers here on the panel to make sure we zip through. So let's go to the students now. Go ahead and say your name and your question.
Hi, my name is Bella Krantz. I was kind of wondering about like the young adults and young voters of America who really have no real way of affording college. So I guess my question is, do you think college affordability will be a major platform issue for candidates in 2020, or not really at all?
Well, here's what I've learned about young voters over the years. One of the reasons why politicians don't respond to young voters is because they don't vote. If they organize and vote, that's when politicians will pay attention to them. That's why they pay attention to your grandparents, because they vote. That's why things like Social Security and Medicare are difficult issues for any politician to come out and say they're going to make cuts to. So you got to vote, you got to organize, you got to be part of it.
Okay, so let's go back to the students. Go ahead and say your name and what your question is.
Hello, my name is Maya. My question was, how do you think ideology affects the voting process and being nonpartisan while having a mass media bias in today's world?
Oh, goodness. Let me just clarify. Are you asking whether journalists have to deal with their bias or that the candidates are dealing with bias? Okay. You specialize sort of in this type of conversation, Dr.
Yeah, Blue. Ideology. So your question is really about how voters deal with the ideological divides. This is really a unique thing in U.S. politics. So until the 70s, 80s, we didn't have this like strict alignment of liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. It seems that there's a craving for people who are in the center, and whatever that means is relative to what's on the two poles. However, if many of the Democratic candidates could just decide, converge on one person, that could play to the center. I'm not sure if this is really the answer to your question, but I'm trying.
It seems, though, that, I mean, with mass media becoming more mass, that it's driving ideology in a lot of ways, is it not? Because every particular branch of the ideological tree has some sort of niche website, radio program, television
echo chambers.
Program. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that question, Maya. We really appreciate it. We've got about 2.5 minutes. We want to get both of these questions in. So step on up, say your name, and give us your question.
Hi, my name is Amir. And my question is, do you think that one of the political parties could split into two separate parties in the next few years?
No.
Okay, that's a no from Dr. Bloom.
No, I mean, the Republicans did that in 1856. The Whigs became the Republican Party, but and there are internal, I think the Republican Party is more united than ever before. I don't think that it's going to happen anytime soon either.
Very good question, though, and that will be interesting to watch.
Can I add the real reason, though, is electoral laws, not lack
yes,
of will.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
That really puts you at a disadvantage if you're not in one of the establishment parties, just mm-hmm. the way it's set up.
Yeah. Right.
Hi, what's your name and what's your question?
Okay, hi. My name is Christy. I was wondering what you all think about the Medal of Honor that Rush Limbaugh got at the State of the Union address.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. No, you're
it's amazing. We're on against him. Why what are we?
It's amazing that that he got the same award that Rosa Parks and Maya Angelou and people like that has done that. I think it was also interesting that the airman, one of the Tuskegee Airmen was sitting right next to him. If anybody deserved a medal, it
right.
was that person who survived, the 100-year-old man, not right. somebody who has preached. Look, there are conservatives who like him, but he does preach divisiveness.
He has the largest radio audience in America. About 15 million people listen to him every week. He is number one and has been for
Michael,
the better part of three
you
decades.
You are number two, by the way. You're number two.
What are you calling me, a number two?
Number two.
That's very rude. You're a guest on my program. Christy, that's a great question, and I think it just speaks, yeah. of course, to the political priorities and sort of the who you're speaking to as a leader and a candidate when you make those types of decisions. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Mr. Harvey Lewis is here. I think we've got a total of a minute left for the question and the answer. Famed marathoner. Go on, Mr. Lewis.
Thanks so much, and we really are grateful for the opportunity to come here with our students, so thanks so much.
All your pleasantries are eating up your time.
There we go. So, a great question for you here. The what is the lowest that anyone has ever placed in the New Hampshire primary or Iowa caucus and still come back and gain the nomination of their party?
Jimmy Carter won 27% of the primary in New Hampshire in 1976 and got the nomination.
And where did he rank overall? Do you remember?
What did he want?
Like, where did he rank in terms of placements with other competitors?
He won New Hampshire.
Oh, he won New Hampshire.
So his question is, like, who did poorly in Iowa or
yeah,
New
like
Hampshire?
Amy Klobuchar, she finished fifth. Like, Joe Biden, is he finished
John McCain fourth. Finished fourth in Iowa in 2008, got the nomination then. And in 1988, both third-place finishers in Iowa, George Bush and Michael Dukakis, finished third in Iowa, both went on to win the nomination.
So you don't think that the Iowa caucus is all doomed for Joe Biden's team?
No, but he's getting pretty close to that.
But he thanks you for your optimism. My thanks to Harvey Lewis and the students from the School for the Creative and Performing Arts for being with us. To the political junkie, Ken Rudin, for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
To Dr. Rachel Bloom from Miami for being here. And Howard Wilkinson for having no choice but to be here again. Thank you as well. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can catch this broadcast again online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.